Thank you, Jerry. As we look at today's lesson, that high priestly prayer does make us question a little bit of how did we get where we are today, and how do we relate to all of that in light of what Jesus said. Hopefully, we can take an honest look at this situation and what happened without necessarily blaming particular groups and so forth, but I think we want to be honest and take a clear look at it. So we are ready for lesson 11, as was stated. And if you'll, I did put this verse in here again because I think it relates. We may look at this again a little bit at the end. It does relate to the lesson as well today. In Jude, where it says, it was needful for me to write unto you and exhort you that you should earnestly contend for the faith which was once delivered unto the saints. At the end of last lesson, we looked at some things in the Mennonites in the 20th century, beliefs and practices among Anabaptists grew further and further apart, which we'll see more of that happening in today's lesson. This caused many divisions and new groups, and so today's topics, as mentioned in the book, are conscientious objection to war, and maybe how some of that affected the church and some of the change, the value of voluntary service, which kind of came out of that, the CPS and the 1W service kind of brought a new maybe emphasis on people volunteering, and we still have people going into service today, young people especially. One of the things in the book here talks about church standards, their use and abuse, although there's not a whole lot in our book that really talks about that in our lesson today, so maybe you can be thinking about that, and maybe you'll have some questions at the end, but we will talk briefly about that as it weaves in with the rest of the discussion. Church divisions and how to relate to other groups is also mentioned. So let's take a look first, as it does in the book, about conscientious objection to war and what happened there. So the atrocities of North America wars prior to World War II had an effect on what we see then in today's lesson. COs were subjected to mistreatment, and we talked about this a little bit in one of the previous lessons, imprisonment, places like Fort Lewis, Fort Leavenworth, and yes, there were even some on Alcatraz Island for being a CO, and a lot of other things that took place during that time. I should actually read, let's see if I have that article with me. The government assumed that COs would be converted into soldiers once they were exposed to life in their assigned military camps. Simultaneously, and this is something I was not aware of until actually looking at this lesson this week, this would have been during like World War I. The Justice Department was preparing to indict 181 Mennonite leaders for violating the Espionage Act because of a statement they adopted against performing military service. I don't know if those 181 church leaders knew that they might be indicted by the Justice Department under the Espionage Act, but that would be a pretty serious indictment. I understand that did not happen then, but they were thinking about it. The draftees' refusal to put on a uniform or cooperate with many in any way caused difficulties for both the government and the COs. The treatment received by nearly 2,000 of these absolute COs included short rations, solitary confinement, physical abuse so severe that as to cause the deaths of two Hutterite draftees. After World War I and another European war looming, leaders from the historic peace churches met to strategize about how to cooperate with the government to avoid the difficulties of World War I. Holding a common view that any participation in military service was not acceptable, they devised a plan of civilian alternative service based on experience gained by the American Friends Service Committee, and I'm assuming that would be your Quakers, the Friends Church, Quakers, work in Europe during and after World War I, and forestry service done by Russian Mennonites in lieu of military service in Russia. As the United States prepared for another war, the historic peace churches presented by friends who understood inner dealings of Washington, D.C. politics attempted to influence new draft bills to ensure their men could fulfill their duty in an alternative non-military type service. And then we ended up with what we would call CPS, or civilian public service. I don't think there is anyone here that would have been in CPS at this point. Is that correct? I think you're all too young for that. I know at least Sari's dad, Henry, I'm pretty sure was involved in CPS, I think out west somewhere, and I'm sure there were others here at Salem that may have been, but I know that Henry would have been. And so this was something that was done during World War II. Most of the cost of the CPS camps was paid by the church organizations supporting the programs. So they actually paid to support the CPS work that was going on. Men received a monthly allowance of $2.50 to $5. And that, actually in today's money, I had seen what that was, and I don't think it was over $100, maybe $105 for the $5 and what it would be today. Per month to be involved in that. They could put in extra work at area farms or other places if they felt like doing extra work after they were putting out forest fires or removing snow from the passes or whatever they were doing. If they wanted to work a little bit more, make a little more money, they could. I don't know that was the normal thing. Federal government did spend as much as $1.3 million on CPS. And in return, the men provided $6 million in unpaid labor. So I'd say the government got their money out of that one. But it was much, much better than what happened in World War I. And had it not been for a lot of the church leaders getting together, it just would have been like the Friends or Quakers and Mennonites and some brethren churches and so forth getting together and coming up with a plan. World War II may have not been any different for COs than was World War I. Types of works included soil conservation, agriculture, forestry. A lot of forestry work was done, and some mental health facilities. This map here shows you where a lot of these camps were. Over here, the purple one is Mennonite Central Committee, or MCC, hosting those. This is the American Friends, Brethren. I'm not sure what these all are. You even see the Association of Catholic Conscientious Objectors. There's, I think, one up here, maybe a couple more. But the purple ones are places where you can see that the Mennonites would have had CPS camps where they were doing work and allowing places for their men to be. We get past that. And we have the 1W program. How many of you here were involved in the 1W program? I see two. I know Dave Cross was as well. Grace is back there. Lowell would have been involved in that. He was out at Westville. I know Bill Yoder was involved in it, probably others. But I didn't ask you ahead of time. Jerry, you were in Arizona, right? What was your responsibility there? What did you do in 1W service?
I was in Harley for Central Supply, which delivered surgical supplies to the
hospital. Okay, so you delivered surgical, but it was the medical field. You were involved in the medical field. Dale, where were you for sure?
I was in Evanston Hospital, which is a suburb north of Chicago.
Okay. Okay, very good. So you had some experiences in that. We're going to talk a little bit about 1W service and what I at least would say the effects on the church were at that point. Government and other organizations were approved by selective service to participate in the program of the 1W service. And a large percentage of the men worked in hospitals or mental institutions. I'm not sure if I have anything else on this note that I wanted to say, but it was actually, they wanted to have some of this right underneath government direction, but some people kind of pushed away from that, and eventually the bill was opened up to where I think it was primarily for governmental and nonprofit organizations could put in to have some of these COs come and work for them, especially if they lost people that went off to war, then the conscientious objectors could come there. The program had its pros and cons. It did bring an awareness of the need for voluntary service, as we talked about. But I want to talk a little bit about the effect, I believe, of the 1W program on the Mennonite Church. And a lot of this comes from my parents. My father was in 1W service in Indianapolis. At that time, they lived down Somerset area. He was farming with his dad at that point. Fortunately, my father and mother were already married at that time. I think that was good. And they went down to Indianapolis. My dad worked in what would be called a private mental institution. It was Norway's. It was right on, I think, the Methodist hospital grounds. There were some 1W workers at the hospital as well. And so they spent 2 years in Indianapolis in a little trailer. I think it was 28 feet long, including the hitch, and probably too small for some of you that like to go camping. In the winter, they had to be careful because the Coke would freeze underneath the bed, and that was not Diet Coke. That was Coke with sugar in it. So it was an interesting life, but they did learn to know some people and gain friends and so forth there. But my father saw young men come down there who were not married, single men, that partied it up. They were probably not even Christian, much less shouldn't have been conscientious objectors. And along with that, and so I guess what I'm saying is, was it better for these young men to be able to go there, get out of military service, and party their life away than it would have been to be in Fort Leavenworth or somewhere actually either having to stand up or join the military? One of the two is the question. Which was really better? But I think beyond that, as far as the effect on the church, so in Indianapolis, for instance, you had a unit house and you had a kind of a unit church to where anyone in Indianapolis that was in 1W service could go there and participate in things, go to church there and so forth. Now, my folks were not that far from their home, so sometimes they'd travel home, but they would go to the unit church as well. It was also available for people who maybe Mennonites that weren't even 1Ws that would go there. I know Dr. Paul Hooley would have went to that when he was in medical school in Indianapolis, would have went to that unit church. My parents got to know him there. And at the same time, we have these other changes going on in the Mennonite churches and these pressures from modernism that we talked about last week from the 1900s and 1930s, the pressure of modernism, pressure of change. A lot of these pressures being put on the church. And what happened in some of these areas, not all as many as others maybe, is you had young people there from all over the country, from all different types of churches, coming together and worshiping. And that was okay. But one of the things that came out of that was, in those settings, people got to know each other, and they would say something like, you know, well, you know, in our church, we're not supposed to do this, or we can't do this, or we've got some standards against this. Oh, really? Well, in our church, we can, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Oh, really? But then maybe in their church, they couldn't do what was done in these churches because of maybe cultural background, maybe their setting, maybe they came from the Amish versus the Mennonites or the Beachy Amish, whatever. And what happened a lot was when these young people all went back to their home churches, they took with them the least common denominator of every other church that participated in those settings and basically tried to bring their home church down standards-wise to every other church that maybe had a lower standard in a particular area, in this area, this area, this area, this area, and it all came back to the home churches and put even more pressure on the conferences and those home churches and leaders to try to accept, oh, well, if they do it in Peoria, Illinois, why can't we do it in Indiana? If they do it in Georgia, why can't we do it in Mississippi? If they do it in Florida, why can't we do it in Arizona? You see what I'm saying? And it put on a lot of pressure. My father would have told me that after World War, or after the Korean conflict, which is where a lot of the early conscientious objectors and 1W service would have been for the Korean conflict, later Vietnam, that after that, he said you could see the effects of it very quickly on his, on their church down at Kokomo and other churches as well. It did play a part. The other effect that it had was more personal, and the fact that a lot of these young men went off to do their service and it ended up in hospitals or other places where they worked side by side with young ladies, often nurses. And I've got an uncle that was working, I believe, in South Bend. Met a lady there, married her, later divorced, remarried, etc. If those young men, and I don't know if Jerry or Dale would want to talk about any pressures they felt in the 1W service, but if they weren't grounded or they weren't married when they went, the pressure was on. And as even our book would say, a lot of young men lost their way through the 1W service. I think the CPS service was better because it was groups of men out working, doing their things. They were not necessarily put in those types of situations, but you had a lot of country boys that ended up in the cities in places they had not experienced, with people that they had not experienced that kind of pressure, many of them. And it did have its effect. The church lost a lot of young men through that program. Now, am I saying that there shouldn't have been a 1W program? Would I have wanted to have to go to Alcatraz Island to stand up for my faith? But I do wonder if the draft would have still been going and I would have went off to service somewhere not having been married and put in those types of temptations, where would I have ended up? I don't know. I would hope I would have come out of it okay, but I don't know. It was a lot of pressure for a lot of young men, and a number of them did not make it, and a lot of them, and again, there were other pressures from the 1W service that came back on churches and affected the standards of those churches. Well, then we have the hippie era from about the 1960s to 70s, and our book talks about it a little bit, and it did have an effect on the Mennonite church. I almost put a picture in here of a bunch of hippies from the 70s or something, or 60s, but I decided not to. But how many of you here, we're going to really show our age, remember the hippie era? Yeah, there's numbers of us. Well, yeah, not necessarily. There's a song that came out a number of years ago. I forget the whole song, but something about he's an old hippie and he don't know what to do. Should he grab onto the, hang on to the old or grab onto the new or something? I don't know. But anyway, they're still around and it still has its effect on culture. I was quite young in the 60s. I was born in the 60s, so I don't remember some of the beginnings of it. But I do remember a lot of it, especially in the late 60s and the more early 70s. And unfortunately, when I was looking at a few of those pictures and saw some of the bell-bottom pants, I thought about, and a few of the shirts, I'm like, well, you know what? Now it kind of looks familiar. I kind of remember some of that. Some of those things carried on up through the late 70s as well. It did put pressure, that era did put pressure on boys like myself, especially when I was going to elementary school, I was in a public school, and I was like, do we have to get a haircut again? Do I have to get my haircut? Because the boys at school weren't getting their haircut, and they were elementary students. I also wanted a pair of dingo boots. My parents wouldn't let me have those either. I didn't know what was wrong with them, but anyway, it was part of the culture. And none of you probably know what those were either. So, the hippie movement, and talks a little bit about it in the book and in the teacher's book about the fact that we do have to recognize, we'll go through a few points here. You also had the civil rights issues that were a lot more prevalent in the 50s and then moved into the 60s. It was a reaction to prosperity, for one thing, and it was also a reaction to the Vietnam War, and I don't know if I put that in my points, but the Vietnam War was not a popular war, and there was a lot of opposition to it. But the reaction to prosperity, so the baby boomers that came out after World War II, there was a lot of prosperity, a lot of great things going on, people were living it up, et cetera, et cetera. And all of a sudden, there came a generation of young people that were like, there's got to be more to life than this. There's got to be more to life. And what's going on with the government and war and so forth? You also had in with that the whole Watergate scenario with Richard Nixon and so forth. There was just a lot of things going on. And it was a very countercultural movement. Whatever the norm was, let's get rid of it. You may not realize this, and I'm not gonna make a big issue about it this morning, but the fact is, our casual dress, even in this church today, is from the hippie era. Whether you like it or not, it's one of the fruits of that era. It was very countercultural. Get rid of the suits and wear the most psychedelic looking clothes you could. Wear the bell bottoms, wear the blue, and just dress, and often it was as raggedy as you could. Now, I'm not saying we're there, but it had an effect even on how business people dress. There's still the suit and the tie in the business world at a certain level, but it shifted. Go back and look at pictures of people in churches prior to that, and look in church at pictures now, and it's drastically different. It had its effect. It was very, whatever the culture did, we're going to do something different. It brought in the rock music. A lot of drugs were used. And the very much anti-authority. Anything against, any authority was looked down on. That was during the era when policemen were called pigs, and other leaders were called nasty things. And that affected the church and authority within the church, the authority of the church, etc. Very anti-authority. And you also had in it the sexual revolution, which free love, it was often called, which, look around, it has affected our culture drastically today. Much protest against war. How did that affect us? Mennonite colleges, by that time, had moved far away from their moorings, and the colleges picked up on it, because a lot of this movement took place in college campuses around the country, and it was no different in some of our Mennonite colleges. This affected the churches. It put pressure on the churches. It put pressure on this church. I know that. I was a young man, a boy, and growing up and seeing it affect the youth of some of the youth in this church. Youth groups took up the cause. Some church leaders were affected as well and took up the cause. And it made a huge difference on the church. So, and again, we're still dealing with some of those effects. Well, as these things took place in the Mennonite church, and Mennonite churches began to change and to shift, groups began to leave conferences. In your books, there's a list of that talks about quite a few of these, and we're going to go down through them. I thought about trying to give a little bit of a historical overview of all of these, and I decided that's not going to work, not in this amount of time, and you probably aren't that interested in that anyway. If you look on page 119, it talks about some of the conference divisions. The very last paragraph mentions there the conservative Amish Mennonite conference. which later became the Conservative Mennonite Conference. And that was actually, I actually got some PowerPoints on the Conservative Amish Mennonite Conference, on the Midwest Fellowship, because of when I was teaching school. When I was teaching school, I would try to, in Anabaptist history, I would try to, by the end of the year, get to each, every student in the class, their church, bring it right down to their church, the history of their church, which took you through a lot of other churches sometimes to get there. And often you had three or four from the same church, but I think there was one year we had maybe seven different churches represented that we needed to get to. Now, sometimes you'd cover one getting to the others. For instance, if you had Bethel and Sandy Ridge, and if you had students from both those, you're going to cover Bethel when you're getting to Sandy Ridge. But in doing that, it was interesting to look at a lot of these, and it also caused me to call a lot of ministers to just get some history. At that time, there were older men still available in some of those churches, or older people, and call them and ask them some things about, well, how, why did your church start? What happened? How'd you, whatever. And it was really interesting to hear some of their stories and put some of that together. So the Conservative Mennonite Conference would have had a lot of starting right out here in Elkhart and LaGrange County. On page 120 then, it mentions Nationwide Fellowship in the 60s, New Order Amish Churches in the 60s and 68, Eastern Pennsylvania Mennonite Conference, which I think is just called your Eastern Conference now, or that's how it's referenced. You have Southeastern Mennonite Conference, Midwest Fellowship, which would have churches like Bethel and Sandy Ridge, that would have basically come out of some of the conservative conferences. Mid-Atlantic, Hope Mennonite Fellowship, Pilgrim Mennonite Conference, Keystone Mennonite Fellowship, Biblical Mennonite Alliance, or BMA, which is newer, Northeast Conference, and we could go on with the list. There's a lot of others as well we could list. What happened that caused that to happen? So congregations and church leaders were faced with challenges related to their own conferences, not just so much what was going on out there in the world, but what's going on in our own conference. And back then, most Mennonite churches were part of a conference of some kind. This church was part of Indiana-Michigan Conference. With congregations, there were different opinions, even within the congregations and within the conferences, there were different opinions. And starting in the 60s, as we looked, there were a number of them. So, this trend has made it much easier to start new churches and groups. Probably too easy. There was a time when it was just pretty easy to just, or it was very difficult to go off and start a new conference or a new church. People would look very, yeah, if you don't have the backing of your conference or something, oh, what are you doing? It's not that way anymore. And here's a question. Who was actually leaving who? I don't know if that's grammatically correct, but that's the question. I think you understand it. So we started forming a lot of new conferences. A lot of churches left those conferences. Who left who is the question. As a matter of fact, when the conference asked Salem, if I have this, tell me if I'm correct, Jerry, that they asked us, why are you leaving us? We told them, you already left us, right? And what's very interesting is I was just visiting with an elderly lady recently from Yellow Creek. They've now left Yellow Creek Mennonite Church. And I was kind of surprised to hear the words she said, they left us. Even though we left that church, they left us. And I thought, well, that's exactly what we said about the conference 40-some years ago. They left us. There's often this idea when groups divide, and I'm going to be very just open here, that the conservative ones are the problem. They just want more this, they want more that, or whatever, and so they are going to leave and start their own group because they want to be more conservative. And often the claim is made, well, it's just little things. Why does it matter? Well, if it's just little things and why does it matter, then why does it matter if we continue to do them? Is often the question as well. Most of these groups that started by leaving other conferences, not necessarily all of them, but most of them that left did not leave to start something that was more conservative than they had, at least at one time. The group, the conference, was moving, shifting, changing, and they wanted to maintain what they had, and so they started something new. And often it's looked at as kind of the other way around, that, well, they wanted to be more conservative, so they left. They wanted to maintain what they at least had at one time, and so they finally had to pull out or start a new group, a new conference or something. Now, what often happens as a result, and we talked about this a little bit with the Whistler Funk division, what often happens is when that division takes place, there is a tendency then for both groups to move in a direction. I thought about putting a picture up today about put a road with a ditch on both sides. And that can so easily happen in a church, to where the one ditch is, we move so far over here and put up so many restraints to keep everyone in line that we forget what the real heart issues are. And over here is a ditch to where the only thing that matters is the heart, and it's not long until obviously the heart doesn't matter either. And what happens in a lot of these divisions, what has happened is when they divided, then the conservative-minded or those who wanted to maintain tend to move further in that direction, and the ones over here that didn't want to definitely moved in that direction. You could see that in the Whistler, in the Funk-Whistler split, and you could see it in other groups as well. The Mennonite Church, including most progressive or liberal conferences, continue to fracture and divide. I was sitting in a meeting a number of years ago, probably 25 years ago, when Mennonite Church USA was being formed. Mennonite Church USA was going to be the answer to uniting the mainstream Mennonite Church. Now, not those of us that had left, but the General Conference Mennonites and the Old Conference Mennonites and all these different Lancaster Conference and Allegheny Conference and Virginia Conference and Indiana Michigan Conference and the General Conference, all Mennonite Church USA, we're going to get all into one big unit, bring unity. And in that meeting, I remember some men like George Brunk and J. Otis Yoder and some of those older, more experienced, learned men saying, "It's not going to work. We're going to end up with a lot more divisions in the Mennonite church than what we've got now." Now, they weren't a part of that at that point anymore, but what they were saying was, Mennonite Church USA is not going to bring a big unified church. And it didn't. There has been more splintering in the Mennonite conferences, even the more liberal conferences since that time, than for many years before. Many of the churches in this community that were once part of Indiana Michigan conferences are no longer. There have been other conferences formed. There's been more splintering and dividing. One of the reasons for that is because you still had those like General Conference and even Indiana Michigan Conference now who wanted to push further and further. Homosexuality, women in leadership, transgenderism, you name it, they're for it. And so there are those within those groups that are like, no, we're not for that. And so it has continued to divide and fracture. So we come back to this. How do we earnestly contend for the faith that was once delivered to the saints without continuing to fracture and divide and bite and devour and et cetera, et cetera? I think sometimes we look at these divisions and these groups and we have this idea that, well, what they did. Oh, there's Dave. I didn't even see you sitting up here. You were in 1W service, weren't you? You weren't. I thought you were. Okay, you just went into voluntary service. Okay. You should have hollered at me when I said that. I didn't see you up here. Okay, back on track. So, there's this idea often that these divisions took place for unnecessary reasons. And sometimes egos and personalities did play a part. There's no doubt about that. But I think often when these divisions took place, especially when the Mennonite church in the 20th century moved and kept moving in a worldly direction and an unscriptural direction and an untheological direction, like I mentioned the other week, a lot of the Mennonite colleges and seminaries and so forth began to teach the idea that the Word of God contains the Word of God. It isn't the Word of God, etc. And these things filtered out through the conferences and people left. And so we look at that and we say, well, what was going on? Was it necessary? Why did we do this? I think there were a number of men and women, I'm sure, that were earnestly contending for the faith and saw no other option. And that still happens. Ephesians says, see then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time because the days are evil. Wherefore, be ye not unwise, but understanding what the will of the Lord is. Circumspectly is two words. It's pretty easy to understand what that means. Circumspectly, the circum part is like a circle, circumference, circle, whatever. And spectly is spectacles, glasses. Look around is all that word means. Look around. Be observant. Be discerning. Look around. See what's going on to determine what the will of the Lord is and determine what the will of the Lord is. And I think if you put those two things together, you have people, and leaders, church leaders, people within any group. And if you think this splintering and this division in the 20th century was just Mennonites, you're wrong. The Methodists have done it. The Baptists have done it. As the view and understanding of the church and the Word began to shift and change in a lot of different groups, this right here, people were trying to maintain. People were trying to earnestly contend for the faith, whether they were Baptist or Methodist or Presbyterian or whatever. There have been different groups that have come out of those because of this very reason. And so how do we, and I guess here's the question now, we get to this part. How do we recognize and accept other people's level of how they, as we often say, how they do church? How they practice what the Bible says, how we put into practice what we believe the Bible teaches. How can we respect each other in those places, in their churches, not being condemning, but then not necessarily accepting their views and everything either? How is that done? And I don't know that we can answer that this morning, other than the fact that I do think I was thinking there was something that I wanted to read that John wrote here in the teacher's book. It says, on the one hand, factions formed over differences about cars, electricity, electronic media, dress standards, or veiling styles make us pause to consider what or who is at the center of our gathering. Are we truly following Jesus? On the other hand, they also demonstrate how strongly conservative Anabaptists believe that true faith in Jesus finds expression in all areas of living. Still, in our differences, we sometimes forget that the enemy is the world, not our brothers and sisters in Jesus. Even though our conservative Anabaptist groups do do differ, there is far more that unites us than differentiates us. This should cause us to respect one another and work together in God's kingdom as we are able, rather than work behind walls of hostility and suspicion. I thought he put that pretty well, and yet we have to put that into practice and yet maintain what we believe is a good, practical, and just a good way to continue to practice what God has taught in his word. Any thoughts on that? And maybe I should mention, one of the things that puts pressures on us today, I talked about that whole thing of the 1W service and people taking home their least common denominators, if you will, from every other group. It was social media early on, is what it basically was. Today, that whole pressure on groups has exploded through social media as people see what this group does. It's okay here. If it's okay there, then why isn't it okay here? Again, how do we respect each other and maybe some differences without necessarily feeling like we have to be like them or them be like us, etc.? And it's always easier, by the way, isn't it? Always easier to respect the more conservative groups to a certain level. And we start questioning why they're so conservative. And the ones that are more liberal, then we start getting a little nervous, but we don't realize that we're the more liberal ones to other people right in this community. And so how do we... I think you really hit on something there, though, Tim. We had a common goal. We all came. I think we, for the most part, left our differences, checked them at the door, if you will. We came there. We worshiped together. We did our thing. But I wasn't trying to encourage any of those who were from more conservative backgrounds that they had to practice like me. They weren't telling me I needed to practice like them and so forth. That was not part of this. It was more a focus on here's something that we all need improvement in or need to know more about, we need to grow in, and let's do it together. And I think that is where, I think that can happen if we are not bent then on trying to change each other or going there and feeling like we have to change to be like this group or this group or this group. We're there for that goal. And
well, the one thing Shane said that first thing he said was how he met that man in Walmart or wherever, where he wondered if he was a Christian, he said he was, and then Shane asked him if he was. Yeah. Anyway, he said, when he reached out his hand and shook his leg, well, you'll be a fine neighbor in heaven. Well, probably, Church where Shane came and preached that Sunday morning. We practice things so different, but yet, 100 years from now, like, can we say, "Let's be neighbors in heaven and live our lives in a way that we can"? I mean, obviously, there's not going to be sin there. Like, we have to live a pure life, but we can go to different churches, we can look different, we can practice different, yet still be neighbors in heaven. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Tim. Anyone else have a thought on that or something you want to share? Okay. Thank you for your fine attention, and you are dismissed.